Explained SCPs. When is an SCP not an SCP? The Foundation is devoted to capturing and containing anomalies, and while they do plenty of research and testing on them, that's really only to further their goals and make them easier to contain. It's not really their intention to ever explain how an anomaly exists or where it came from, although that does happen from time to time. Sometimes, though, through the course of their research, they discover that an anomaly is not actually anomalous at all, earning it the explained tag. Of course, things aren't always that clear-cut, but we're going to check out a handful of explained articles to see how the Foundation figures out what's normal and what's not. Let's take a look. Let's start off with SCP-3000-EX, the collective designation for a set of four modified hospital beds and other items which were hypothesized to have mind-affecting properties. Comprehensive testing of the items, a person of interest, and all other materials recovered in conjunction have confirmed that they are not anomalous. The full list of items include four hospital beds that have been modified by the attachment of short lengths of metal pipes of various sizes and configurations attached to the side rails by metal clamps or crude welding. There are also seven IKEA brand directional floor lamps, 12 bottles of sleeping pills, 9 pairs of handcuffs, several of which were attached to the metal pipes on the beds, 6 steak knives, a knife sharpener, a chest freezer containing multiple cuts of beef, and 3 eviscerated human corpses. The bodies were all teenaged males, identified as 3 missing persons from Texas. The items were recovered on April 4, 1987, following interception of police communications with a high incidence of trigger phrases, which included murder, ritual, kids, flesh, speaking in tongues, and cult-like. Agents were deployed to the crime scene, a suburban house in Arlington, Texas, owned by a Carl Frazier, who had been arrested by the police. All of the items were located in the basement of the house, with the bodies handcuffed to the hospital beds, and they had been dead for between 5 days and 3 months before discovery. They all were emaciated and showed signs of malnutrition and starvation, with their torsos smeared with a combination of human and animal blood. Cause of death was determined to be severe internal bleeding, organ damage, and disembowelment, likely with the steak knives found at the scene. Each was also found to be holding a steak knife in their right hand. Further investigation revealed a pit dug beneath the garage, filled with quicklime and containing body parts from at least 10 unidentified individuals. Based on the use of animal blood and the apparent self-inflicted wounds, agents suspected the possibility of a compulsion effect generated by one or more of the items. Frazier was interviewed, and he quickly admitted that he killed the boys, or at least had to help kill them. They did it themselves, and he had to help. He's asked where the hospital beds came from, and he says that he bought them. His grandma had one and she died, but he liked how the mattress felt when he lays down on it, so he bought some more. He put the metal on them so their arms could reach, and he jammed the backs so they were sitting up a little bit and could lean forward. He's asked if he did anything else to the beds, and if he knows anything about magic. He appears clueless to the line of questioning, and he's asked if the beds made the boys hurt themselves by speaking into their minds, but he doesn't understand what they're talking about. He's then asked if he put the animal blood on them, but he says they did it themselves, and it was an accident. When asked why he killed them, he yells that he didn't, he just helped. He killed the first ones, but he didn't know any better and was funny from the beer. He just grabbed his neck to stop him leaving, and then woke up and he was dead. He didn't mean to, but he was so pretty, and he didn't want him to leave. He's asked about one of the bodies they found, and Frazier says that he had a strong face and bright eyes, but he got too weak. He tried feeding them once he got the handcuffs and the basement arranged, but they didn't want to eat. He realized that the food was making them less beautiful, so he realized that the only way they could stay beautiful was if they ate themselves. It's like a beautiful loop, and the beauty goes around and around and never wears off. He couldn't make them understand, though, even though he gave them the knives and told them, so he had an idea. After one woke up and was on the bed, yelling, he told him that he had to eat himself. Eventually, after enough days, he put a frozen steak on his belly and told him he could eat it. He knew that the freezer makes the meat harder and slippery for the knife, and he knew how sharp the knife was. If he could only start cutting, he would smell his body, and he would be so hungry, and then the beauty would go on and on forever. But he was too weak, and couldn't hold the knife steady enough, so Frazier had to help him. He always had to help them, even though he didn't want to, and the beauty always went out of them afterwards. The Foundation then tried asking Frazier about a number of groups of interest and persons of interest, including Adatum's Wake, the Order of the White Worm, Ayun, and the Fifth Church, but he had never heard of any of them, and polygraph results confirmed it. He was amnesticized and returned to jail for his trial. We're given a newspaper article, however, from a few months later, stating that the murder trial for the Arlington cannibal was thrown out of court yesterday when the DA's case collapsed in spectacular fashion. The alleged murderer has been released from custody after being accused of the gruesome murders in his home. A police officer told the court the shocking details of his discovery of the bodies, but his testimony faltered during cross-examination. Under a barrage of questions, he admitted that he could not clearly remember his actions for a significant period immediately after discovering the bodies, and he could not explain this confusion. The police records for the case were then shown, showing gaps in the custody of the alleged murder weapons and other evidence, which the officer could not explain. He was adamant that he had nothing to hide, but admitted that he could not rule out tampering with the crime scene or the evidence during the alleged gaps. Following this answer, the case was thrown out and Frazier was released. The SCP article was updated a few days later to note that the Foundation's standard procedures for the use of amnestics have been amended. So, not only did the Foundation investigate an anomaly that turned out to just be a crazy serial killer, they meddled with the case enough to get him released scot-free. Boy, I really hope somebody got fired for that blunder. Next, we have SCP-2700-EX, an anomalous multi-stage illness with an exceptionally infectious nature. While it has been found to affect male subjects, it is over 100 times more likely to infect females, and it's hypothesized that around 12.5% of women worldwide are currently infected with some form of it. The infection causes the cellular breakdown at the apoptosis stage, and rather than dying naturally, cells affected by the infection will continue to live and group together into large clumps, causing a number of symptoms. These include unusual thickness of the skin and puckering or dimpling of the skin, a rash or discharge around the infection site, constant pain and swelling at the infection site, and necrotizing of surrounding tissue causing black, oozing sores. More severe cases may become metastatic, spreading throughout the body and multiplying symptoms across multiple sites. Left untreated, the infection can lead to full-body necrotizing fasciitis and something that's redacted. Researcher Harold Perry has volunteered to lead research into the infection, but we're given a log of infractions against Perry and a note from the Ethics Committee. They note that the symptoms of the infection are, in fact, all factual symptoms of breast cancer, and 12.5% of women born each year will likely face it at some point in their life. All Perry had to do was exaggerate a symptom and claim that it was a highly contagious epidemic, which let him both claim the anomaly and get the ability to quarantine himself with his work. Various pieces of evidence against him have been gathered from his research notes, email correspondence, and security footage. On January 17th, 2015, he notes that a new group of D-class has come in, and their new detection protocols are becoming more and more accurate, allowing them to screen and find multiple infected subjects. 10 days later, he writes that one of the D-class passed away, and whatever this is, it hits hard and fast. It's better to have as few people involved as possible on the project to make sure they can keep this contained. A week later, he writes that he's getting worried about the stability of one D-class, and places her in long-term care while they continue work on the other subjects. Security footage from 10 days later shows him leaving the medical ward, entering a men's restroom, exiting carrying a red heart-shaped box, and returning to the medical ward. He sends an email a month later to the head researcher on a different SCP, requesting a cross-test with the SCP to check for efficacy. The researcher agrees, and Perry notes a couple of days later that a D-class responded exceptionally poorly to treatment with it. Another D-class seems stable, but he can tell that she's getting weaker. A few weeks later, he writes that one D-class was responding well to a treatment cycle, but was not cured, and another is deteriorating more rapidly than before. He sends a request to another head researcher about another cross-test, but this researcher denies the request. A week later, he writes that they may have found a breakthrough, as one D-class is responding very well to a treatment cycle. Her tumors seem to be shrinking, and her energy levels are going up. A couple more weeks later, however, in a note written with a more erratic hand, he writes that she died. He swears and writes that they have all this cutting-edge technology, all of these anomalies, and what the hell are they good for? Monica doesn't have much time left, and he wonders what he's going to do. 2 days later, Perry was subdued during an attempt to steal an instance of another SCP. At an ethics committee deliberations meeting, they discuss Perry's case, with him being charged with one count of falsifying D-class collection procedures, one count of falsifying containment documentation, reckless use of D-class personnel, reckless use of an anomalous object, two counts of assaulting security personnel, and one count of attempted theft of an SCP. SCP-2700-EX has been determined to be non-anomalous breast cancer, and Perry cherry-picked and exaggerated symptoms and completely falsified the highly contagious aspect to both cover this fact and gain tighter control of the project using quarantine protocols. From there, he misused D-class personnel and at least one anomaly, as well as attempting to steal an SCP. The O5 Council recommends forced retirement and placement into civilian society at level C. The committee chair says to put him at level A, and they'll end up settling with the council at level B. In the meantime, they should hold Perry at Medi-Site 42 until his wife passes. He won't remember it after they set him loose, but the chair will sleep better. So they sort of had us there in the first half, I think, as we're likely just conditioned to assume that a researcher going around the Foundation's back to work with D-class is up to something nefarious. In this case, however, Perry's wife was suffering from breast cancer while he worked for one of the most powerful and technologically advanced organizations to ever exist. Of course, cancer isn't anomalous, so the Foundation could sort of care less about it, leading Perry to make up a fake infection so he could utilize the Foundation's resources to try to save his wife. The Foundation does, of course, have at least a few cures for cancer available to them through anomalies, which the O5 Council absolutely utilizes, but that's not going to save Perry's wife. Let's move on to SCP-1933-EX, a creature measuring an estimated 6 to 8 meters in length, residing in a lake in British Columbia. Exact details vary from report to report, but it is almost always reported to have a long, serpent-like neck and head, a similarly long tail, dark blue coloration, and long, leaf-like protrusions running from the base of its head to the end of its body. However, in each report of sighting, it has quickly been determined to have been a misidentified common occurrence, such as a large piece of driftwood, large eel or fish, or simple unreliable testimony. Recovered footage of it has been easily explained by photo or video manipulation, or intentional staging to simulate an encounter. It is most likely that reports of the creature are the result of subjects being influenced by local myths and legends. That's the revised description, however, and we're provided the original description, which is mostly similar. It states that details regarding its lower half are predominantly unknown, as it has never been observed to beach itself, or surface more than its neck and upper half of its body. As it does not appear to possess gills, it is currently theorized to reside in an underwater cave, which is currently being searched for using sonar. It has been observed camouflaging itself with aquatic plants or fallen trees, and ambushing large prey that approaches the water, as well as preying on passing birds and fish. It has been observed to actively avoid boats in most situations, but has occasionally attacked solitary humans entering or around the lake. It also possesses a secondary effect, possibly mimetic in nature, that causes those who become aware of it from any method except first-hand experience to become extremely unwilling to consider its existence. This can include finding flaws in a subject's testimony that are not actually present, seeing wires, animatronics, or photo manipulation where none are present, or verbally shutting down conversation regarding SCP-1933. This is thought to be the result of a defense mechanism designed to keep potential prey from becoming wary of approaching the lake. While this has caused significant delay in documentation and observation, it has expedited ensuring civilians do not become aware of it. At time of writing, only a small group of researchers are aware of it, and a way of informing the rest of the foundation of its existence is being researched. It's noted that an experiment will soon take place with the intent of proving the creature's existence. It will be lured to the surface using an elk carcass deposited in the middle of the lake. A doctor will then contact an MTF and attempt to live stream an appearance directly to them. If this is a success, then they will have taken the first step in successfully containing it. Otherwise, they'll probably all be brought in for questioning and/or amnestic treatments. An addendum is then added stating that SCP-1933 was reclassified to Explained after a group of researchers contacted an MTF claiming to have evidence of a possible new cognitohazardous entity, which would be demonstrated to them over a private livestream. The MTF personnel viewing the livestream reported that the researchers had constructed an animatronic to resemble the entity they were referring to, which rose out of the lake and dragged under the carcass of an elk. The researchers were quickly located and brought in for questioning, and the head researcher was reprimanded for abuse and waste of Foundation researchers. He was later discovered to have been drowned in the lake roughly a week after the reclassification in an unrelated boating accident, although it's noted that the location of the boat is unknown and there are no reports of him buying or renting a boat prior. Allegations that he had appeared to have been half-eaten are currently under investigation, and the official cause of death is believed to be drowning after extensive blood loss due to injury from a boat propeller. At first glance, this sure seems to be the Foundation at their absolute dumbest, as it seems quite obvious that they're dealing with a mimetic hazard, and they should have more experience with things like that than they're displaying here. It is possible, however, that the revised description is absolutely correct, that there is no creature, and people are just influenced by local myths and legends to either think they're seeing something where there's nothing, or are purposefully staging things. After all, people have claimed to see all sorts of things in our world, like Bigfoot or the Jersey Devil, and the chances that those are all mimetic hazards is a lot lower than people just being mistaken or faking it. Really though, the Foundation should just cut through the BS and pulled a Mr. Burns, draining the lake and pulling it out of there. Next we have SCP-1763-EX, a large nocturnal carnivorous mammal formerly native to farmland in rural England. SCP-1763 possesses minor perception-altering capabilities, which it uses to conceal itself through rudimentary camouflage. When given sufficient opportunity, it displays an extremely predatory nature. Its morphology is somewhat variable, as is the strength of its primary anomalous effect, with the entity tending to increase in size and decrease in visibility over time. It is hypothesized that this represents accelerated adaptation to an environment in which observation is nearly constant, and the potential limit to this adaptation is unknown. As it has so far been responsible for upwards of 30 fatalities while in containment, research is currently a high-level priority. That document was written in February of 1984, and was updated in 1989, showing that it has now grown from 12 meters in length to 18. It's also been determined to be able to disguise both its physical appearance and any sound it makes, and is capable of removing memories of such qualities from nearby individuals. When given sufficient opportunity, it will utilize these abilities to stalk, hunt, and kill any potential prey. Its morphology is extremely variable, and it tends to increase in size and decrease in general perceptibility over time. As it has so far been responsible for upwards of 30 fatalities while in containment, research is currently discontinued. Another update from 6 years later states that 1763 is currently contained within a large area of woodland, bordered by an electrified chain-link fence, and the remains of Site 94 located at the center of this area are off-limits to all personnel. Its description states that it is a largely imperceptible creature, estimated to be upwards of 24 meters in length. It is carnivorous and predatory towards all higher life forms, and as such poses a high threat to any persons within the containment zone. It cannot be directly considered by any subjects within a large radius, and can exert an unspecified mimetic effect on any subjects who have directly seen evidence of the entity's existence. A total of 30 deaths have been attributed to it since its initial containment, but the actual figure is expected to be at least double this. The last update is from an unknown date, in which it has no object class, and no plan for containment for it has been devised. Any areas referred to as Site 94 or Area 764 are to be reported immediately, and under no circumstances should any personnel enter these areas. No contact with the entity can currently be made. Its description states that it is a semi-metaphysical entity capable of excising itself at will from various aspects of reality, both real and imagined. It is currently both invisible and silent, possesses no heat signature, can render itself selectively intangible, and is capable of exerting a strong mimetic effect on nearby humans, removing, censoring, and corrupting information about itself stored in the subject's brain. Additionally, tangentially related information in a variety of mediums is suspected to be at risk, though this is unconfirmed. Due to a lack of staff assigned to the project, all research on 1763 is postponed for the foreseeable future. A total of 30 deaths have been attributed to 1763 since its cataloging on an unknown date, but despite this, no records of any such deceased persons exist. Its motive for attacking and killing Foundation personnel, if any, is unknown. Several other iterations of this article have been located, referring to the entity as a physical creature, so it's believed that it was at one point both actively contained by the Foundation and not able to exert the range of anomalous phenomena available to it at present. Further inference suggests that its excision of itself from standard methods of perception is part of an ongoing trend, in which the entity is rendered less real over time, possibly as a survival technique, natural adaptation, or as a method of acquiring food. For obvious reasons, no elements of this hypothesis can be verified, and whether or not it does in fact exist is currently unclear. The article becomes corrupted at this point, and data is listed as missing. We're then told that these documents were recovered from the personal computer of an unknown researcher in 2018. This is believed to be a categorization for a non-existent anomaly, possibly devised for recreational or academic purposes, and classified as explained after brief confusion arising from its discovery. Personnel are reminded that no entities or phenomena portrayed within represent any manner of threat to either the Foundation, staff, or the human population in general, and are in fact entirely fictional. So, according to the Foundation, they just found these documents on someone's computer and believe it to be fake, a fictional SCP article written in-universe by a Foundation member. I can't imagine that happens too often in that universe, but it's plausible enough. The problem, of course, is that the supposedly fake anomaly is all about manipulating reality and perceptions to make it imperceptible. If it were a real SCP, it sure sounds like it could achieve a goal of being believed to be fictional, while still being entirely real. According to the author, there isn't a canon answer here, but it's certainly a bit of a mind trip. Next, we have SCP-012-EX, which states that the original file for this one has been deleted due to containing fabricated evidence, and to inhibit attempts to waste Foundation resources in replicating the tests. The previous warning on this file, which was that it must not be read in the dark, may be disregarded. SCP-012-EX is the paranoid sensation that one is being stalked by some form of unseen, malicious entity, typically up one or more flights of stairs, in low-light conditions. It is common in children and teens, and may persist until adulthood, with it also being more prevalent in Western cultures, primarily being experienced in suburban settings. Before its redesignation as explained, this article referred to malevolent entities which manifest in close proximity to a human target, in dark and poorly lit areas when the subject is alone. The previous iteration also clarified that approximately one-third of humans possess an innate ability to sense the presence of their 012-EX, but there was no data to support this claim. Through neural imaging and interviews with affected persons, it has proven to be merely a combination of various fears, such as pterophobia and climacophobia. Further, the sensation can be exacerbated by the consumption of horror media. It's likely due to this last fact that the falsified documents stated that they appear with more regularity near persons actively panicking or who are feeling fearful and paranoid. It is unknown why these persons are seemingly preferred, but it should be noted that those who dwell on thoughts pertaining to their SCP-012 instances coincide with said instances presenting with higher degrees of clarity and definition while under indirect observation. Though never regarded with any credibility throughout the Foundation's existence, Dr. Theodore Richardson posited the existence of a class of undetectable entities responsible for 012-EX. Due to the prevalence of discussion regarding the sensation throughout various forums and social media platforms, the decision was made to allow him to begin investigating the phenomena. Despite repeated tests purporting to document the existence of malicious entities through the use of pressure plates, laser detection, and sonar imagery, all documentation was found to contain no concrete evidence. Regarding the supposed physicality of the entities, Richardson writes that they are mostly humanoid, though are unbound by human physiology when it comes to ambulation and range of motion, being able to twist and contort their frames into any desired position. The contortion is mainly used to remain unseen, such as slipping beneath a bed frame or hiding behind obstructions. During one observation, a manifestation stretched its limbs to brace itself between two opposing walls, staying well above its target's line of sight as it stalked her in her home. The project was forcibly disbanded by the site director following several complaints from the participating D-class subjects, who each voluntarily left the project due to stress caused by Richardson's mental state as he developed a debilitating fear of the dark. I didn't know that that was something the D-Class could just do. On the night preceding the project's disbandment, where three Foundation lives were lost in an unrelated incident, Richardson remarked in his personal journal that, "They know we can see them." He was placed on paid leave, and his documentation was put on hold for review. 2 days later, his neighborhood experienced a power outage. He dialed the site's emergency response number, but was not present on the other side of the line when the call connected. Within minutes, local police were called because of sounds of struggle coming from the home. Agent Locke is dispatched to investigate, and we're given her video log. The body cam activates as she exits her vehicle. Emergency lights are present throughout the neighborhood, and as she crosses the street, a squad car rounds the corner, lights activated, and stops in front of the house. Locke introduces herself with her federal credentials, and the officer replies that he's responding to a possible domestic dispute, leading the two to head to the front door together. Crunching glass is heard as one of them steps on a pair of glasses on the way up, and they see that the curtains are drawn. With the exception of a flickering of a flashlight coming from a room on the second floor, the house is dark. Locke rings the doorbell, and the officer loudly declares their presence, but they receive no response. Upon knocking, they notice that the door is slightly ajar, so they enter, with the officer drawing his weapon. Turning on her flashlight, Locke reveals a living room in mild disarray. The sofa is notably crooked, with the far end being forcibly shoved aside towards a door leading to the kitchen. A glass table that had presumably sat center of the room had been wholly upended and cast aside, shattered, and a recliner was sitting on its back near the front door. In addition, there appeared to have been an attempt to set the home ablaze, with a blackened trail of burnt carpet fiber streaking through the destruction. As Locke kneels to investigate this trail, a woman's sobbing can be heard from above. The two cautiously approach the stairway as the officer identifies himself again as a police officer, eliciting no response from the woman. They ascend the first few steps, stepping over the fractured, burnt remains of a cell phone, and it becomes apparent as they climb that the sobbing is coming from a room near the end of the hall. The door is ajar, and the two advance very slowly. There is then a loud, inhuman groaning, and the sobs rapidly turn to frenzied shrieks, leading the two to quicken their approach. The screams cut off just as Locke opens the door, showing the Richardsons' bedroom, largely undisturbed. A large comforter, bundled tightly, lays hanging off the foot of the bed, twisting around and trailing the floor underneath. A full canvas of the home revealed that neither Richardson nor his wife were present. Collected from the home were a crushed pair of glasses belonging to Richardson, 4 cubic centimeters of burnt carpet, a burnt and destroyed personal cell phone verified to have made the emergency call, and a floral comforter, the bottom of which was shredded and wet with an unidentified clear fluid. Alright, so the current version of this article indicates that 012-EX just refers to a paranoid sensation about being stalked by a creature in the dark. This sensation is more prevalent amongst younger people, particularly in Western cultures, and is exacerbated by the consumption of horror media. This isn't really surprising, and definitely wouldn't warrant an article on its own. Many people are creeped out by being alone in a dark environment, and that can get even worse if you just watched a scary movie. The former version of the article, however, indicates that this wasn't just a paranoid sensation, but there are actually malicious entities which can manifest in dark areas when a subject is by themselves. According to the current article, there never was any data to back this up, leading to the Foundation slapping the explained class on it, but it sure seems like there was some data. Richardson's research notes indicate that they did observe the entities in testing, and the sequence of events in his home also heavily suggests that these things are real. Theories abound, but it's possible that the entities are indeed real, but can only really manifest if one believes that they could manifest. In that case, the Foundation changing the article to be explained and presenting it as just a paranoid sensation rather than actual entities that will kill you in the dark if you believe they can is a preventative measure. If no one believes these things exist, no one can be harmed by them, at least in theory. Lastly, let's end with SCP-8900-EX, which was designated as Keter Class due to extreme difficulty in containment. Persons and objects affected by it are to be quarantined and destroyed via flash incineration immediately. Flames resulting from this process are to be extinguished by vacuum in complete darkness to suppress the spread of infection. SCP-8900 is a complex perceptual phenomenon affecting the visual spectrum, which seems to spread by contact. It can be photographed using certain newly developed techniques, but the process of photographing the anomaly seems to result in faster spread of its effect and is considered inadvisable. It is currently uncontained and is theoretically uncontainable. It first began to appear in the mid to late 1800s as a side effect of certain photography techniques, but was restrained only to the photographic plates themselves and did not spread. It first developed as the Foundation knows it today in or around 1935, possibly as a result of a corporation's experiments with integral tri-pack technology. An addendum from the desk of 058 reads, "Gentlemen, we have failed. SCP-8900's effects have become so widespread as to be commonplace. The natural blue of the sky has been replaced with a gross and unnatural shade, and the green of trees has been equally corrupted. SCP-8900 has brought ruin down upon the entire visible spectrum, and we have been overrun. Our attempt at creating an opposing infection has also failed. Although we were successful at restoring the natural colorization of our test subjects, the process seems to render them mute, and now a runner has arrived at my office to tell me that our little experiment has breached containment. Future agents may have to deal with it as an SCP object in its own right. We are left with only one option, gentlemen. I am activating the Foundation's final failsafe method, the Ennui Protocol. By the time this message reaches those of you cleared to receive it, Foundation resources on a global scale will have released vast amounts of compound Ennui 5, our most subtle amnestic. Worldwide, men and women who do not deserve the horror wreaked upon them will pause, confused, then resume their business, confident that this is the way it has always been, never knowing what they have lost. Only the photographs not affected by SCP-8900's taint will remain to tell the truth. I regret this, gentlemen. I regret it deeply. It must be done. 058. Secure, contain, protect." So, if it's not clear, what this article is stating is that the world used to actually be in black and white before an infection caused everything to change into what we now know as color. Based on the O5's note, the people before the infection also saw everything in color, but to modern eyes, it just looks black and white. Our blue skies looked unnatural and wrong to their eyes, just as a black and white sky would look pretty unnatural to our eyes. It's certainly meant to be a bit of a humorous article, poking fun at the idea that the world was actually in black and white before the advent of color photography, but it is a pretty surreal concept. If all of our perceptions suddenly changed, and things no longer looked as we're accustomed to, there would be quite a bit of chaos. It's clear that the explained category is oftentimes used for a subversion of the normal formula. Much like the inversion of the whodunit formula, where the audience knows from the start who the killer is, We know from the start of an explained article that the anomaly in question is, at the very least, suspect. Somewhat humorously, there is often very little explained about an explained article, and many of them still largely rely on the audience filling in a gap or two, much like many normal articles. The purpose of them, then, isn't for the Foundation to lay out exactly how they came to understand an anomaly, but rather for the reader to figure out why the Foundation would label it as explained, especially if it's still, to our eyes, somewhat unexplained. After all, SCPs are often interesting precisely because they're inexplicable.